The Beach with a Bossa Nova beat, a tune from Antonio Carlos Jobim, No More Blues. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, The Beach, Summertime Escape. The seashore rejuvenates, lets us relax or kick up our heels. But for most of our history, for most of us, the beach was a hostile, frightening place. Shores were to be protected. They were points of departure for fishermen and explorers, some of whom never returned. Our guests today are the authors of A History of the Beach, Lena Lencheck and Gideon Bosker. The title of their book is The Beach, The History of Paradise on Earth. As we talk, you're encouraged to join us with your questions and comments in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Lena Lencheck and Gideon Bosker are co-authors of more than 9 books. Lencheck is a professor of Russian and the humanities at Reed College. Bosker, a physician, is an assistant professor of medicine at Yale University School of Medicine. They live in Portland with another beachgoer, their daughter, Bianca. The Beach, The History of Paradise on Earth, is published by Viking. Questions about beaches? Our guests can answer them. And you might also tell us about your favorite beach or share a memory from the seashore. Toll free 1-800-222-9455. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Lena Lencheck and Gideon Bosker, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon,
Celeste. Good afternoon, Celeste. Thanks for having us.
Sure, my pleasure. Have you been to the beach this summer?
Yes, we've been to quite a few beaches, actually. We've been on the Oregon coast and on the Mediterranean and a little bit on the Atlantic as well. So I think we've put in our beach time.
Yeah.
It's been a beachy keen summer.
And of the beaches that you've visited this summer, do you have one that was really a beach experience that was really outstanding?
Yeah, there's a standout. You know, the French and the English have been going to the beaches of France, for a good 150 years, and really getting a chance to colonize it, to decorate it, to civilize it. And the beaches there have a combination of restaurants that abut right against the shore, and we were on the beaches of Saint-Tropez with my 89-year-old mother, and people who aren't familiar with those beaches should just be warned that you really don't know what you're going to encounter in the way of erogenous zones from one beach to the next, and you can take sort of a walk down the beach, and all of a sudden various degrees of dermatologic exposure come your way. So here's my 89-year-old mother with a heart condition, and we're having a merry time walking along the beach, and I'm kidding her about, you know, come on, Mom, just take it all off, just like the people do here. And then all of a sudden we get to Liberty Beach, and then we get to Neptune Beach and Venus Beach, and all of a sudden the bathing suits have gone by the wayside, and we see humanity between the ages of 2 and 92 years of age completely in the buff. And of course, my mother is desperately reaching for her nitroglycerin and just can't believe that we're taking her through this descent into this salacious life. And meanwhile, my 11-year-old daughter is filming with the video camera saying, oh, what a great place for a hula hoop contest. So, yeah, there are all kinds of beach experiences, and that one is certainly memorable.
So your mother kept it all on.
She kept it, yeah. She kept it all on and made a beeline right back for the safety of her umbrella.
Yeah. You know, the book includes illustrations of all manner of beach-related material. I like to think of them as mini postcards of the history of the beach. And one of these images that I'm particularly drawn to, you know, as we've started off here talking about bathing costumes or the lack thereof, is a model wearing what was in the mid-1960s known as the scandal suit.
Yes, the scandal suit looks tame to us by comparison with things that we've since seen on the beach, but it caused a major scandal in the 1960s, which we remember as a time when skin really went public on American beaches with the Woodstock generation, when one's politics were measured by in the number of square inches that one bared. The scandal suit was
The,
very tricky piece of clothing. It peeled, it cut out vast areas of fabric, but then covered them with netting. So it was a kind of peekaboo suit. And what was most scandalous about it was the fact that the advertising campaign for this suit was staged on a brass bed that was dragged out on the sea. So this was the most explicit association that had been made to date between Eros, between the boudoir and the beach, as a site of erotic encounters.
Yeah. So it was really a costume that appropriated elements of lingerie and bedroom fashion with a beach costume. And although people were under the impression that the swimsuit was on an inexorable one-way journey to steamy Never-Never Land, that being no swimsuit at all, in fact, the history is much more complex than that, because, in fact, at the point in the 1970s when Rudy Gernreich introduced the topless suit, although it had a lot of media exposure and attention, in fact, beachgoers rebelled against it, and very few suits were sold. So you see this pendulum swinging between more and less coverage, but in the case of the scandal suit that you point out, it was the sort of purient implications of the netting that really caused all the stir.
And the beach has been really central in tuning our attitudes to the body in the 20th century. When the swimsuit began to lose square inches in the beginning of the 20th century, all of those defense sartorial clothing defense mechanisms that in the 19th century had maintained some sort of democracy or equality among anatomical types on the beach dropped away. Now it really, the beach became a place where the anatomical haves and the anatomical have-nots were exposed. A very traumatic experience for women in the 20th century has been buying a swimsuit. And what we've seen is that from decade to decade, the swimsuit has bared different parts of the human anatomy, acting as a kind of italics that always calls attention to new erogenous zones. So, for example, in the 20s, the legs were all the rage. In the 30s, it was the back. In the 40s and the 50s, it was the bosom. In the 60s, it was finally the navel that was bared. And in the 70s, the upper thigh. So we see, in fact, that the on the beach, as the tides come and go, revealing the parts of the sand, so the swimsuit has come and gone, revealing different parts of the anatomy.
Yeah. Now, long before the scandal suit, there was the bikini, and this goes way back.
Well, it goes back farther than people realize. Mm-hmm. In 1946, when two Frenchmen introduced the bikini, or what was then called, another name for it was the atome, A-T-O-M-E, because it was so atomically small. It was composed of a set of protons for the top of the body and electrons for the bottom of the body. And also happened to have been due to coincide with the first detonation of a nuclear device over the Bikini Atoll. So there was a relationship between these 129 square inches of cloth. But the point that you make to us is it was, in fact, introduced in 1946, but it wasn't until the culture was ripe and ready for the exposure of skin that it became a popular item of fashion. It wasn't, in fact, until 1965 that the bikini was introduced into the fashion mainstream. But as someone once said, the bikini was a place where you knew everything about a woman besides her maiden name, you know, and that's probably still true.
Yeah. And Celeste, actually, when you say that the bikini is much older, predates the scandal suit, we can find very venerable precedents to the bikini in the culture of the ancient Romans.
Mm-hmm.
Their archaeologists have found a mosaic in a villa in Sicily dating from the 3rd century A.D. That shows female gymnasts in a garment that looks exactly like a bikini.
And apparently also there are some Minoan paintings that are even older, 1600 B.C.
Yes. So it is an old idea that never seems to fade.
I think one of the most interesting examples of seeing precedents for modern suits is that in the 1930s, Janssen had little swimsuits for boys, and in fact, it looks just like the topless Rudi Gernreich suit with just a strap going up the middle. So one, it's possible that it, in fact, was derived for a little suit for boys.
Hmm. Let's talk a bit about how beaches are formed. I love the way you write about sand in this book. You bring poetry to science. Talk with us about how beaches are formed. You say it's a dance of earth, water, wind, and sun. How do they come together?
Yes. There are two fundamental ways in which sands on the beaches are formed. One is through geological action, mechanical action, that is the erosion of the rocks under the pressure, the constant assault of the waves pounding against them, of water, and the transportation of ground-up rock particles from the mountains along by the rivers that are brought and deposited in the estuaries. Another mode of creating beaches is through the is organic, that is the bodies of sea creatures, of seashells, of crabs, depending on their source. So we have, for example, the beautiful pink beaches in the Pacific Islands, or the black, dark, gritty beaches that are formed by volcanic exhalations, or the crystalline, sparkling beaches of the Baja California or the West Coast that are produced by the crumbling of the sandstone with pieces of quartz in them, a kind of oceanic bouillabaisse, as Gideon likes to call it. And this process is constantly going on. And so when we walk on the sands of a beach, we're actually walking on history. We're walking on the past, on materials that have been brought from different places and that still carry with them the memory of an ancient
I think one of the interesting things people don't think of often is that there are really different sounds that different sands make around the world, just like they say that people inhabiting Alaska and the Eskimos have several different ways of describing the color of snow. There are some sands that whistle and some that sing and some that bark and moan and some that crunch and some that pop, and all of those are dependent upon the particular characteristics that have been given to them by eons of geological torture. There are the 12-second sands of New Zealand, where people have 12 seconds to make it from the perimeter of the beach into the water, or their feet literally go up in flames because it's so hot. And there are the hourglass powdered sugar fine sands of Destin Beach in Florida on the Gulf. So a beach is not a beach is not a beach. And the other thing is that these sands are constantly shifting sort of in random metamorphoses over time. And there's now the art of plastic or science of plastic surgery, or what I call beach augmentation. The vast beach resorts, whether it be Miami Beach or the beaches off of California, required augmentation over time, interestingly with silicone, because there is a lot of silica in those sands, to prevent erosion from sort of nudging up against these hotel properties or developments, etc. So the beach takes a constant process of augmentation and maintenance over time.
Yeah. Now, sand can be dated. How is that done, and where are the oldest beach sands?
Well, sand can be dated through various, I suppose, carbon dating techniques, and by examination, microscopic examination, chemical examination. Some of the oldest beaches we can find along the Atlantic.
Well, the oldest beaches tend to occur wherever the spumes of volcanic islands were formed. Those are sands or that come from deep within the earth are upchucked in the process of tectonic plate shifting, and fumes leave those islands there, and the sands eventually reflect ancient geological activity. Now, some islands, of course, are recently formed, as we've seen in the Pacific, but the original ones are formed from the action of spumes from tectonic plates. But
and beaches are in constant motion. That's why your question, which are the oldest beaches, is sort of a tricky question to answer, in as much as that is their whole purpose, is to provide that flexible membrane between these implacable geological formations, the water and the earth, and their function is to roll over, to absorb the shock, to expand, to shrink with the seasons, to be really very responsive. That's one of the most compelling reasons for developers to constantly try to protect them, you know, to keep them, to protect their real estate investments and so on. But naturally, of course, the beaches are, the beach is new from each season. You go down to Cabo San Lucas, for example, in the wintertime, the beach is very high and those beautiful rocks are almost covered. You go back 6 months later and the rocks jut out 10, 12, 15 feet and the sand is very low down. You almost don't recognize it as the same place. So it's an environment that is never the same, even from one time of day to another time of day. And that's its beauty, that's its attraction, is to be able to see kind of speeded up geological time played out on the shore.
If you've ever been at the shore and there's been a storm comes up, you leave the beach, and when you come back, it's a very different place.
Exactly. Yes, it is.
Would you help us understand differences in tides? It was so interesting to learn how much power a wave can pack.
Mm-hmm.
In some places, waves and tides are gentler than in other places. In Nantucket Island, tides that are 1-2 feet, but then go north to the Bay of Fundy, and tides are 40 to 50 feet high. How does that happen?
Tides are responses of the water to the pull, gravitational pull of the moon and the sun. And so they vary depending on the position of the Earth with respect to the moon and the sun. And they vary with respect to the basin in which the water is moved around. We think of, it's useful to think of it as the area of the sea as a kind of basin that we wash our hands in, and the water sloshes in and out of it. So when the gravitational pull on one side of the Earth is particularly strong, it will suck up the waters in that direction and then release them, and they will vibrate or move according to a certain frequency in each area. Now, in the Bay of Fundy, the geological properties of the bay and of the underlying continental shelf affect the way in which the water moves and travels across the ocean bottom. So that accounts for very high tides. Also, the proximity to the equator, the distance from the equator, determines the height of the tides. In the tropics, in Tahiti, for example, there are virtually no tides. There is very little fluctuation. In the Mediterranean, we also have virtually no tides because the Mediterranean is contained within, it's an inland sea. Certain of the oceans, as we go further towards the poles, the tides increase, to make a generalization. As we come closer to the equator, the tides are more gentle and less extreme.
Mm. I know a little seashore grocery in New Brunswick, and the store posts the week's specials on the windows, you know, with posters, also in the windows are signs reminding passersby they can get a tide table
right.
in the store, as well as a marriage license.
So you can time your wedding to all, not coincide with high tide.
All life's necessities.
Exactly.
In one little grocery store.
Yeah. Well, it's absolutely essential for the clam diggers to know when that tide's going to be out. So they can...
Or gold diggers, I guess, in the case.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the fluctuation of the tides, by the way, was a very important variable in the early years of the beach in the 18th century and the very early 19th century when bathing was conducted from so-called bathing machines, which were wooden cabin on wheels that the bather entered from one end and then was hauled into waist or chest-high water. And then emerged from the other door to go swimming. And in order to maneuver these cumbersome large machines, bathing spas had to find beaches that had long sloping ingress into the water, long slope, and that had very predictable tides so that the bathing could be done as the tide was high. And none of the particular topology of the beach would make it impossible for them to use these machines. Of course...
Well, probably the most interesting thing in terms of controlling the tides, which we can't do, is the development of so-called indoor beaches, beaches in a box, beaches in a can, beaches beneath a dome. And the Japanese have pioneered this area. They've actually developed an indoor beach complete with 90 million gallons of water. They've created artificial tides that are substantial enough for indoor surfing, complete with sand that's cleaned and groomed every day. So the beach has become such a sought-after outpost of paradise that if there isn't enough natural shoreline to accommodate people, they actually build beaches themselves as running water machines. It's sort mm-hmm. of a an upscale version of the water park theme, but entirely made like a diorama to recreate the sensation of a beach.
And again, there's nothing new that isn't old in some way. Again, the ancient Romans, who were the great beach fanatics, used the tides in order to fill their beaches. They created painstakingly out of granite and various, also other precious stones and marble, pools at the seashore that were filled twice a day with clean water. Even though the tides in the Mediterranean are extremely gentle, still they were sufficient to provide fresh water twice a day, fresh salt water twice a day, to permit swimming. And so the tides have been an essential part in the beach experience.
Mm. Does the facility in Japan, does it have wave action?
Yes, it actually has wave action. It's sufficient for surfboarding and for body surfing. It actually has wave action.
And they can crank up the waves or tone them down depending on what activities they want their clients to participate in.
Is this a spot you'd like to go to?
We've never been there. It's called Seagaya.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to visit, and they're apparently building another one, but it's... I think a very interesting example of trying to build paradise out of sand, water, wind, and stone. And, of course, the climate is perfectly regulated.
Yeah.
And you don't need SPF because it's under a dome.
You have to come with your tan already in
exactly.
place.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we're far away from the shore. You know, Lake Michigan calls every once in a while, and we can head up to the beach there at the Great Lakes. But this idea of a beach in a mall, I don't know how I feel about it. I feel a little conflicted. It's not quite the same as really going to the seashore.
That's
but
right.
But on the other hand, if you're in Nebraska, you know, that might not be such a bad thing at all.
Exactly. In fact, there is a precedent to this again in the 60s when surfing became such a popular activity on in California that people in the Midwest and in landlocked parts of the country, feeling deprived, did install actually surf machines in various malls so one could practice one's surfing and be ready when one got to the ocean and to the big waves.
If you look at the development and history of water parks and water amusements, the day probably is not very far off when beach-like environments will, in fact, be created for inland destinations. Janssen Beach here in Portland, Oregon, in the 1930s, in fact, developed something called the Janssen Beach Park. And really, it was an oversized swimming pool, and they had sand hauled in from the beach that it was used to line the swimming pool, the outside area of, or the apron of the swimming pool. And people just loved it. They set up chairs and umbrellas just like the beach, but eventually the sand clogged the filtration system and they had to get rid of it, so it was just an old-fashioned swimming pool. But if you look at some of the tremendous developments in water park activities, it probably will become more beach-like in the future.
Yeah. It's interesting to think that once upon a time, bathing was seen as unhealthy, and the seashore was kind of a scary place, unless you lived in a place like Tahiti. Then eventually that fear fell away, and the seaside was seen as therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
And people were told to drink a glass of seawater and take a plunge into that cold, icy water in the nude. It's good for you.
Yes. Well, it took a great number of small changes to bring people to the beach. After the collapse of the Roman Empire in the 5th century A.D., the beach really went into disuse for a good 1,200 years. One of the reasons was that the Nordic peoples, the barbarians, the Visigoths who overran the empire came from the north and they had no use for cold water. Another was the influence of religious ideology. In the Bible, for example, we find that the Garden of Eden had no beach. It was a beautiful, landlocked, tame landscape. There were also images of the beach from natural history that posited that the original world, as created by God, was flat without sharp mountains and crevices and abysses, and that when God sent down the great deluge and flooded the earth, that was when the beaches were created, so that the seashore was really seen as the place that carried the imprint of divine judgment, of divine wrath. It was a site of terror, and so one went to the beach really to think about one's sins, to think about one's unworthiness. And so we see
And one might remember, not ideologically, but topologically and geologically, it was a terrifying place. All the places we now take for granted as being cleared of shrub and trees, etc., went right up to the margin of the ocean. It was a very difficult thing to even negotiate and get to the seaside. And looking at the out at the ocean during the Middle Ages was much like looking up at the unknown cosmos now. It was absolutely unknown what lurked in those seas. And long before Steven Spielberg created Jaws, there were limb-chomping creatures that were imputed or inferred to be in the ocean and made the sea a very hostile place intellectually. And as Lena is about to say, we had to dominate the sea intellectually, ideologically, and rid it of all these creatures that had been imputed to be there in order to make it something that was worthy for us. And as you point out, Celeste, that was the notion that it had therapeutic value. And, of course, that came out of commerce. There were inland spas, baths, baths that were safely protected inland, and somebody had the bright idea of saying, well, gee, if water is so good, why don't we just use water that's ubiquitous, that's free of charge, and take people down to the sea and have them drink cold seawater and immerse them in these frigid waters, and it'll build character and it'll get rid of neuroses and bladder problems and melancholy. And that was really what motivated the seaside activities from the mid-17th century until the mid-18th century.
Hmm. Now, those early seaside health spas and resorts, did they differ greatly from what we see today?
Yes, they did. For one thing, the bathing season until really 150 years ago, the bathing season ran from November through March. What was sought after was the action of the cold seawater and the cold air. And again, this was a factor of medicinal theories and illnesses, that the action of the cold water encouraged the circulation of the blood, it revitalized the functioning of the organs, and so on. So cold was the operative word here. Fact is also that the physical appearance of these resorts was different, in as much as there were these bathing machines that were lined up along the seashore. There were very few boardwalks, if any, 200 years ago. And the resort facilities, if you will, the hotels, were quite modest in scale. In the end of the 18th century, in Scarborough, England, and Weymouth, for example, the fashionable architecture began to appear in these resorts because they attracted royalty from England, from all over Europe, actually. So various pavilions in Oriental style, fanciful architecture began to appear in these places.
But the beaches were very different. In very simple terms, over time, people went to the beach initially for water. They thought it had curative powers. It didn't. Then they went to the beach for
air
because mm-hmm. they thought it cured or helped cure tuberculosis, which it didn't. And now they go to the beach to shop, which may or may not cure mm-hmm. certain problems. But the bottom line is all of the medicinal advantages or benefits that were assumed to be part of the beach-going experience have really been debunked by medical science over time. In fact, we've gone to the other side of things, thinking that the sun is harmful, which it is because it causes skin cancer. So to go to the beach now is to go to the beach primarily to relax and to protect yourself against the elements, and that's one of the things that has allowed the beach to become such a hospitable place. You know, when we look at a beach landscape now and we see people sitting under their Sombrella Fabrics umbrella, and they have SPF titanium oxide sun protection factor, when we see them wearing their Lycra suits, as subtle as these things are, they represent major technological milestones that have made the beach-going experience a relatively safe and comfortable endeavor. As little as 80 years ago, going to the beach in the cities of New England or the Northeast for day trippers was a horrendous experience. There was no suntan lotion. People came back burned and fried and red-faced. They had mild heat strokes. They were puking on the trains on the way back from the beaches. It was a terrible experience. They were wearing clothes that were 35 pounds when wet because there were no ultra-light fabrics. So we really had to apply technological development to the beach-going experience to make it the sweet and light experience that we now associate with it today.
Mm. We're talking this afternoon about the beach with two guests, Gideon Bosker and Lena Lencheck. They are the authors of the book, The Beach, The History of Paradise on Earth. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Your questions about the beach are welcome. You can join us with a telephone call, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So when did it become pleasurable to go to the beach? And when did eroticism arrive on the beach?
Well, I guess for each generation, the pleasure was it was in the eye of the beholder. That is, that in the 19th century, for example, the romantic poets, Wordsworth and Coleridge and Byron and Shelley and Swinburne, became passionate addicts of the beach because they saw the seashore as a place from which they could confront the sea and see the sea as a reflection of their souls. They were tremendous egoists. So for them, the pleasure of the beach was the pleasure of seeing themselves in this tremendous natural landscape. In the latter half of the 19th century, as day tripping became possible, thanks to the railroad engine, to the train, the steam engine and railroad tracks that were laid out, urban dwellers came to the beach to enjoy the crowds, the congregation, and places like Blackpool in England or Coney Island in New York began to provide all sorts of diversions, mechanical rides that gave people the experience of speed. This was an absolutely new physiological experience. So it gave people all sorts of new physiological experiences, speed, the sensation of immersing themselves in the water.
And, of course, there's surfing. We can't forget the importance of surfing. You know, surfers are in many ways modern-day explorers of this very dangerous, tumultuous aqua territory between the sea and land. Initially, surfing began with long planks where people sort of almost in groups, almost like a buddy system, just sort of gradually surfed their way to shore under relatively calm waves because the long planks didn't allow for the maneuverability. Now, if you look at the kinds of aqua territory, if you look at that very rarefied part of turbulent ocean that people are able to negotiate with the light short surfboards now into the pipeline with that canopy of meringue above them, literally slithering through this particular 20-30 foot wave. That's also an interesting development. The recreational aspects of the beach also have depended on technological developments over time.
As far as the beach becoming a site of erotic encounters, that certainly took a momentum in the 20th century when clothing began to grow scantier and scantier. The beach, in fact, in America was the site of impassioned confrontations between the law and beachgoers who wanted to show more skin. The 20s, the 30s, saw many, many episodes of young women being dragged off to paddy wagons because they revealed forbidden inches of thigh,
right.
Or young men who were hauled off. In fact, we often forget the fact that the battle to liberate the male torso for exposure was also hard won. Really until...
people never could have imagined Baywatch movies. There was this quiet sexuality that was muffled. It was a place where young kids sort of in their prime of their adolescence rebelled against the older generation, and they did so with very strong erotic overtones. But even back to the days of Bougainvillea sailing through the South Pacific, there were already notes in these logs about people in the South Pacific running up to the boats and offering sexual favors in exchange for certain...
Well, as welcome rituals to the sailors, the newcomers, in the 16th, 17th century, as these European explorers approached the tropical islands, they were always greeted by maidens coming in canoes who threw themselves at them as forms of greeting, of welcome. So their vision of the beach was of a place of sexual gratification.
Yeah. You know, it seems to me that in the 60s and into the 70s, no matter where you were in the United States, you were surrounded by beach culture, whether it was the Beach Boys or whether it was beach movies. whether it was the idea of, you know, everybody wanted to be a California girl.
Well, there was that, but remember the beach was the end of the road, and in the 1960s when we grew up, there was a movement. You would do your political activities in the cities, and then you'd have to bail out. You'd have to go somewhere where the community was natural, where it was part of the earth, where it was your own, where you were secluded and sequestered from all the polluting influences of corporate urban culture. And that spawned tremendous migrations to beaches all over the world. If you talk to people now in their 40s and 50s, when they had their first beach experiences, most of them will say, oh, it was in the 1960s off of Mazatlan, Mexico, or it was driving down to Baja in 1973.
Yeah, or in the Greek Isles.
Or in the Greek Islands, or Ibiza off Spain. These were, remember, there's that old saying, the beach is where marginal people congregate, and it is where respectable people congregate to perform, to act in marginal ways. So, no question that beach culture was a place where people set up little huts. It was a place where drugs could be used away from the prying eye of the FBI or the local police authorities, and they were literally satellite communities of Theodore Rozhak's counterculture, and the beach provided the best ambience for that possible.
Really interesting. We're here at the end of the time that we can spend together today. I want to ask you about, before we go, about the prognosis for the beach. You write in the book that more shores are retreating than advancing. Mm-hmm. What's the outlook for our beaches?
Well, I think there's two things to say here. As far as the cultural impact of the beach, the outlook is really good. We know that President Clinton, for example, is going to retire to the beach after he gives his evidence to recover perhaps his lost innocence. But in terms of, in geological terms, the beach is in fact imperiled. As we crowd into it, we pollute it, we overdevelop it. A natural erosion and the rising of the level of the ocean is also doing its work. So I don't think we should take it for granted that the beach will always be with us, and we should try to cherish it and enjoy it to the fullest while we can. So I strongly urge our listeners to pack their bags and head out to the nearest beach.
Sounds like a fabulous idea.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Thanks for having us.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Gideon Bosker and Lena Lenchek have been our guests this afternoon. Look for their book, The Beach, The History of Paradise on Earth. It's published by Viking.
Olha que coisa mais linda, mais cheia de graça. Ela, menina que vem e que passa. Um doce balanço, cado é mais que um poema. É a coisa mais linda que eu já vi passar. Ah, por que estou tão sozinho? Ah, por que tudo é tão triste?